So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F35A.
Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview.
Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District in the U.S. House. He just got reelected to a fourth term, and it's a very interesting time to be in Washington, Congressman Pocan.
Yeah, you know, between the new president, or not so new anymore, and now we took the majority for my first time since I've been in Congress, over 6 years. So lots going on, and it is a real interesting time.
Well, how has your life changed going from the minority to the majority?
It's gotten busier. You know, I got on appropriations last session, but then this session, because we're in the majority, I picked up a third subcommittee. So I serve on the Labor, Human Services, Education Subcommittee, the Agriculture Subcommittee, and now the Energy and Water Subcommittee. So I've got a lot of jurisdiction, a lot of meetings, and it's definitely kept us busier than before.
And you were saying before we started, you're in a key role in terms of UW spending?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure, sure. Of the three subcommittees I'm on, that represents 73% of all the federal dollars that go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison,
and over 73%.
And over 80% of what goes to the system, UW system, statewide. So I would be lying if I didn't say that we did that somewhat with some strategery. You know, we wanted to make sure that, you know, we were doing it to follow where most of our federal dollars that, you know, mean something
and
to
I
folks.
Think I hear your cell phone, President Cross, on the line. But let's talk about some of these larger issues in Washington. Next shoe to drop, the Mueller report, sir?
I don't know. You know, I'm not in the camp that thinks this is, you know, people keep saying, oh, it's going to be this week. Oh, it's going to be this week. I've heard that for weeks. And I think whenever you do something this comprehensive, right, and then you have to do a report after you do all the investigating part, it's not necessarily as quick as you think. So it may be winding down, but it's been just 2 years, not even quite probably 2 years exactly right now. And, you know, don't forget, we spent 4 years on Benghazi with zero indictments, 2 years on Hillary's emails, zero indictments. We're at like 40 or so indictments right now out of this one. And I do think there's some wrapping up. So at the same time, we're doing the proper oversight that didn't occur under Paul Ryan.
Seven U.S. House committees have now begun different investigations of the president.
There's three committees that are probably doing the main general investigating. So that's Judiciary.
Is that Mr. Nadler?
Mr. Nadler.
Nadler.
And then Oversight and Government Reform, Elijah Cummings.
Yes.
And then Intelligence, Adam Schiff. And then committees like mine, we have done in my subcommittee on labor, human services, education, we've had the folks in about the placement of children who are separated from their parents and the facilities they're being held in. So a lot of committees are doing that as well. But the high level stuff really is being done in the three committees. And some of the stuff they're doing, don't forget, wasn't even part of what the Mueller investigation's about. So
That's true.
Just lots happening in general. But it should have happened 2 years prior. And the fact that nothing happened for 2 years just looks like a lot is happening. But part of it's just because it's been pent-up work that hasn't been done.
Is there any doubt in your mind that the entire Mueller report, whenever it comes out, will be released to the public?
We're going to do everything we can to make sure of that. We had a vote that was near unanimous, which is very rare in Congress to say that. But, you know, I still think we're going to have to deal with the Attorney General at the time. And, you know, if they try to play the redaction game, because unfortunately,
yes,
we've both experienced that, you as a journalist and me as a member of Congress and the legislature and getting redacted documents, I could see that still being a battle.
Okay. Let's say the Mueller report is delivered. What are you especially going to look for in it?
I think the president has set up this idea that if there's not collusion, there's nothing in there. And I totally disagree. I think the president's been very smart to set up a false narrative about what the report's about. I think they're looking at lots and lots of stuff. And the fact that the attorney general has always said we can't indict a sitting president because that's how they interpret the law.
Yes.
They may not indict anyone, but have things that would certainly be indictable in the report. So we could have something like that. So I'm looking at all the connections from, you know, Michael Cohen and the campaign finance violations to the campaign contacts to the Russians to all sorts of other stuff around that. So what we're going to be looking for is there something Congress has to step up and do? So if the Attorney General says president's not indictable because that's what he interprets the law to be, mm-hmm. we may then have to step up to look at other things we have to do. Or you may see out of this additional investigations come out of it too, because again, they took a rather narrow area that they're looking at. And there's plenty of other things that we have problems with, the possible violations of the Emoluments Clause, right, with the president's hotel and all of his holdings. There's just a bunch of other areas as well. So I'm looking for not so much collusion. I think that's a false path they're trying to send
false
you down.
Narratives.
Exactly. I'm looking for stuff that could be indictable that maybe no one gets indicted for because of interpretation of the law.
Help me understand this, Speaker Pelosi's recent statement to the Washington Post, impeachment, quote, not worth it. I don't understand that, Mark.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry so much about those three words, but if you look at what she actually says about impeachment, she's exactly right. We can put impeachment on the floor tomorrow and we won't pass it because you need Republican votes. You need a larger threshold to get this done. And right now, Republicans rarely deviate from the president. You're going to need enough evidence to show Republicans that indeed there have been things that are indictable that happened and he hasn't been indicted for it. And there is a further evidence collecting that needs to happen to get to that level. So she's being very pragmatic and saying, I can put it on the floor tomorrow and it won't pass. Here's what we have to do. That's why we're doing our oversight that Paul Ryan refused to do for the last 2 years. So I think, you know, the longer version of what she says makes a lot of sense. I've kind of been saying it all along. I mean, I voted for impeachment last session because I think he's done things already that would fall in that category. However, if we're actually going to pass impeachment and make it an effort of the caucus, it has to happen knowing that you're going to get Republican votes. And that means all the efforts we're doing through the proper oversight now need to happen.
Are you seeing more Republicans breaking with the president? And a U.S. senator today, a Republican U.S. senator, criticized him over his recent tweets over John McCain. Are you seeing more Republicans showing signs or breaking with the president?
First of all, I'd argue not enough, right? I mean, when you start attacking someone who is seen as an American hero, who has passed away, and you're attacking them still, like John McCain and what the president's doing, more people should be speaking out, right? I think it's ridiculous that as many have been silent as they are. But I think the reality is, like you saw on the vote for the overriding the National Declaration of an Emergency, anyone who's up in 2020...
Congressman Gallagher voted for
it. Yeah, in Wisconsin.
Are you surprised by that?
No, because actually I was talking to at least Mike on the floor that day, and I knew he was going to do it. And I thought more Republicans actually would have. I thought we were going to get about 60 Republicans. Okay. That was my guess that day based on conversations I had, because enough people knew that this is a slippery slope. If you allow something that's not really an emergency to be declared a national emergency and take more power away from Congress to the executive branch, wait till there's a Democratic president. Same thing could happen, but on an issue they may not like.
Right.
So it's if you really believe in the institution, it was a vote that you should have voted like Mike Gallagher and Jim Sensenbrenner did. But too many people didn't do that. And on the Senate, it seemed like if you're up in 2020, you didn't vote against the president, but a lot of other people did. And it was an interesting mix of people. It wasn't like just the liberal Republicans or the libertarian Republicans. It was a variety of people who just saw that if we do this, you could then have a very different scenario with a Democratic president that they could really not like. And it shouldn't happen.
The issue of the Mueller report, potential impeachment, how does that interfere with the process of actually governing and passing a budget? And does it paralyze it?
Not really, because, for example, I was on for a little bit my first term, Oversight and Government Reform. Oversight's in the name. That's what they're supposed to do. So they're not dealing with the budget. Appropriations is, right? The Budget Committee does, but really Appropriations is where most of the heavy lifting happens for the 12 bills that we send out that spend the money for the year. So it doesn't matter if other committees are doing things, especially that they're supposed to. I mean, Judiciary has oversight responsibilities. Intelligence has oversight responsibilities. So
Ways and Means and Appropriations are going to continue doing the business of paying the bills?
Yeah, you've got a few things. You might see the tax records of the president come through Ways and Means because that's the proper oversight committee for that. But it's not going to take all their time to do that. That's one thing that they're going to do while they're doing everything else. So, you know, I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think we're going to be doing that. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi has been around for a long time. She knows how to walk, chew gum, sing a tune, play a kazoo, all in high heels at the same time, right? She knows how to do this. I don't think it's going to slow us up from doing the other things we need to do.
You recently released documents from ICE. Can you summarize your takeaway and what you learned from that?
Yeah, you know, I was very disappointed. So back late September, they did a raid in Wisconsin. 83 people were arrested. We were told at the time it was off of a list of 250 people who were criminals, right? We're told that, you know, ICE is supposedly, according to the president, going after gang members, MS-13, drug dealers, and human traffickers. So we wanted to find out when they arrested people and not notifying Dane County law enforcement. Yet 14 other counties in Wisconsin, as early August, we found out through the information we got, were notified, and they never notified our local law enforcement ahead of time. They actually just left a message at the dispatch center, which they knew was not the proper protocol. That was one problem we had. But two, we found out that at least about half of the people had no criminal violations whatsoever. And of the others, the traffic ticket. Some minor stuff as well. So when they put the press release out with four people that I personally would say should be deported, they had a lot of people that weren't. And clearly, now that we saw that list, a lot of those people were not on a list of 250 people because they had no offense whatsoever. So ICE lied to us. ICE didn't properly inform our local law enforcement. And ICE still has not been completely honest with me. I got 290-some redacted pages out of 400. They did not answer a number of my questions, so I have to appeal this after waiting 138 days to get an answer. And so, you know, I certainly sympathize with reporters. Of course, I was a journalism major myself to begin with. But when people make that request and don't get information, you know, we have a right to as a public. I should, especially as a member of Appropriations, you think that they would want to be a little bit more attendant, and they weren't. So, you know, unfortunately, the president has ICE operating not as they were intended, which was after 9/11 to protect us from domestic terrorism. Instead, they're operating as his personal police force to justify the border wall that he promised and never should have in the first place. So there's really an abuse of an agency that's happening. So I look at the White House first, but I also have to look at how ICE is operating.
Well, based on the records that you received, has ICE broken the law?
Broken the law in what sense?
Are they ignoring our statutes?
I think they've broken the law in the information they're supposed to give me, so I'm appealing it.
Okay.
And then if I don't get through with appeal, I'll
FOIA
sue them.
From a FOIA standpoint.
Yeah, from a FOIA standpoint. But what they're doing is not with the intention of why we... The biggest expansion we've had in federal government in most of our adult lifetimes has been Homeland Security.
Yes.
And ICE, right? It was created after 9/11 because of what happened, you know, here in the United States. For domestic terrorism. But if you take an agency that was created for that reason and have them going after people with parking tickets or no violations whatsoever, that clearly is taking them off the focus that they're supposed to do. And I have a huge argument with that. And also, if they're not going to contact local law enforcement, because they said, and we saw one of the emails, there's too radical of a population in Dane County.
In Dane County, that's why they left the message with the dispatcher?
Yes, and they called the sheriff a week before the raids and asked who runs the dispatch center, and he said, why is something about to happen? And they said, no, we're updating our records. After we find out now, for 6 weeks, other law enforcement was notified. It's not maybe not illegal, but certainly immoral in every way I can think of.
Okay, your party's now in power, and you're a leader of the Progressive Caucus. Mm-hmm. Is top priority of the Progressive Caucus Medicare for All?
We have a number of priorities. Medicare for All is certainly one of them. Debt-free college is one of them. Investing in our infrastructure is one of them. A number of other areas, environmental, et cetera.
Which one are you going to move on immediately?
Well, we're kind of doing them all at once. It's not like we're doing one to wait for the next one. So we have commitments to do hearings on Medicare for All. So we're working with the proper committees of jurisdiction right now to get that done. We're going to, as the higher education reauthorization comes, we'd love to see components of our debt-free college put into that bill, perhaps. So we're going to work on that. And one of the things is in the last 2 years, because Congress didn't do much under Paul Ryan's last 2 years, other than pass a tax break for the wealthiest in this country, I had some extra time to build the Progressive Caucus. And I was out raising actually millions of dollars for our 501c3-4 entity. So we are literally going to go from a staff person and a fellow to about 21 staff people in about a month. So we got to have people with our nonprofit entity. We have full-time fellows going into offices to help do policy deep dives in certain areas. We're increasing the staff that work with the caucus internally. And then we've increased our political operation as well. Just recently, we added a political director to add to that operation. So what we've been doing is trying to add capacity so that maybe not in this Congress we're going to pass everything we want because we still have a Republican Senate and a Republican president. But should we get a Democratic president? Should we get a Democratic Senate? we've got a lot better chance to see these things become real.
You mentioned Paul Ryan. You watched him last term, before he retired. Mm-hmm. Was he ground up by the White House on one end and by his Freedom Caucus on the other end? Do you have any sympathy for what he had to go through in that last
term? I think he operated the grinder himself, because rather than standing up to the president, or rather than standing up to his Tea Party, which was a fraction of his caucus and 10% of Congress as a whole, he let them call all the shots. So we were paralyzed from doing anything other than the tax bill. But that was a choice he made on his own. He could have stood up as the Speaker of the House of Representatives, third in line to be president. Instead, he chose not to. So I would argue he was the one actually turning the grinder on himself. And that was really unfortunate, because we are a co-equal branch of government. We should not give up powers to any president, Democratic or Republican, that belong to Congress. And I think we did way too much of that.
Is anybody in Congress worried about the soaring federal debt anymore? The $22 trillion starts with a T?
I'll be honest.
Is that one of your priorities?
No. I mean, the Republicans have given it lip service, but then did the opposite when they passed the tax bill, put $2 trillion of debt in order to give 85% or 86% of that money, I think, goes to the top 1% of people in the country. That was ridiculous. You can't say you're for reducing the debt and then do something like that, because tax expenditures are just that. They're an expenditure, just like you'd spend money on healthcare or on schools. When you spend it on a tax break for rich people, that's a trade-off you make. And they made that trade-off and they added to the debt. So I would argue you do not see the tension that has been in the past on the debt. And I think it will once things get functioning again. But right now, I'm not quite sure if you're going to see this president get there.
What about your premise? Will they get functioning again in Congress?
Well, Congress will start getting functioning again, I think, because we're going to send things out of the House, because they were paralyzed, right? Couldn't pass bills under the Republican leadership because of the Tea Party. We'll send stuff to the Senate. The question is, will they find some things to find consensus in? I do think they will on appropriations and maybe in some other areas on the gun violence prevention, possibly. There's a measure we sent over that had like 85% public support. You'd hope that we could do that. But then we still have the White House to deal with, right? And he's up in 2020. So I think we're at least able to show how government has to function again, and we will send bills out the way things are supposed to happen. But the rest of the process is going to be a little bit in question. But to your specific question, the Republicans, unfortunately, have been complete hypocrites on debt. And because of that, we now have even more to make up for when we ever do address it in a significant, meaningful way.
Okay, but you can do finance. You were joint finance here in the Capitol. How long is our day of reckoning before we have to deal with the $22 trillion and deal with the entitlement program, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid?
Yeah.
How many years can we buy?
I would argue you have fallen for a very false dichotomy that people have spent billions of dollars to put out there. So don't worry. It's not the trade-off.
Re-educate me.
The debt and entitlement programs, which, let's call them what they are, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid, which are some of the most popular federal programs we have, and we all pay into out of our paychecks every week. So we deserve to have our Social Security, and we deserve to have Medicare, and we have Medicaid for people who need it when they fall into those gaps. So I don't accept that it's the debt or those programs. I would argue we spend too much on defense. I would argue we could do some scaling back of the tax cuts that were so frivolously done in the last session. And I think there's other areas you can do to address it. But I just don't want, that's a false dichotomy that people put a lot of money into putting out there. And I want everyone to understand that that's not the trade-off. There are plenty of other things you could do to address debt.
Okay, but there are dates, even though they change, by which Social Security pays out more than it takes in. And same thing with Medicare.
Easy fix. We have not lifted the cap in a very long time. So a lot of people don't know this, but when you make $126,000, that's the current level, or take a little bit, it might have changed a little in this last tax cycle, you don't pay another dime into Social Security. So if you make $1 million, you only pay the tax on the first $126,000. It's a regressive tax, where everything else is a progressive tax when you pay your income tax. First of all, you could either blow the cap completely, and if you make $1 million, you pay that same percent on it, and you'd add 75 years to the life of Medicare and Social Security.
Okay.
Or you could go up to where it should be with inflation, and I think it's somewhere in the 400,000 area, I could be wrong on that, and add decades to the solvency. So really, it's not that difficult of a lift. I think most people would think it's reasonable that if you're making that little bit more, you should be paying a little bit more, especially since it hasn't been adjusted for a very long time.
Let's talk about the amazing 14-candidate field 14 Democrats at the moment.
I don't know. By the time you air this, it's going to go up
to 14. They range in age from, let's see, Representative Tulsi Gabbard is 37. Mr. Sanders is 77. Mr. Biden is 76. You're 55, right?
I think I think Mayor Buttigieg might be 35. He might even be a little younger than Tulsi.
The South Bend mayor?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, you're right in the middle of this generational debate. How do you see it play out? Is having 14, 15, 16 candidates good for your party at this point?
Yeah, I think it is. I think because have it where we'll see where the excitement is in candidates and what message is what the American people are desperate for, especially after Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump has broken all sorts of rules of what it is to be president, right? And I think that's going to change people's appetite. And let's see, is it the fact that Bernie Sanders has for years said that we need to have Medicare for all and a bunch of issues that now are in the mainstream and therefore maybe he's visionary and that counts? Or is it because Beto O'Rourke doesn't talk so much about issues but wants to be better as a country and is aspirational in his message and people are inspired by him? Or is it that it's time for a woman and Kamala Harris from California hits a lot of people's boxes on what they think? I don't know what that answer is. But I'm glad there's a primary system to figure it out, and I think we'll be stronger for having a candidate that addresses what people want at this point in our history.
But at 55, you're right in the middle of this debate. Who should chart the future of your party? The Steny Hoyers, Nancy Pelosi's, Joe Biden, or the AOCs and the Beto O'Rourke? He's only 46. Who should chart the future of your party?
Whatever the voters decide. Right? I don't think, first of all, I don't want it to be dictated by anyone. I'm glad we did the change in superdelegates.
Where are you on this age continuum?
I don't know if it matters. I'm not on the age continuum of who the candidate is. I'm just wondering, is the message more important that someone, like, are people looking for such a stark contrast that a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren is what people are most interested in? Or are they looking for someone who's just a complete opposite in every way from age to everything else, and they're looking at Beto O'Rourke or they're looking at Cory Booker or Kamala Harris? Or does it turn out that, you know, this mayor, again, I mean, usually you wouldn't think someone like that would do all that well, but he's really impressed people when he's in forums right now. Maybe that will shine. I don't know what's going to happen. We're still so early yet, so I'm not too worried about, and I've missed a bunch of candidates that I probably, shouldn't have, but like you said, there's a whole boatload of candidates right now. But whoever comes out of that process, I think will be stronger because they came out of that process.
Do you welcome the imminent announcement by Mr. Biden that he's in? He almost said it last weekend.
Sure. I mean, Biden's going to get in. I think Michael Bennett from Colorado is going to get in yet. God, there's another one I'm forgetting too, who's just on the verge of announcing too. So we're going to be up to 17, I think, at that point.
Wow.
I think a few people will drop by summer even because I don't think, they'll realize that they're not finding a path. And I think it's great, too, that they're coming to Wisconsin already. I mean, Amy Klobuchar has come by. Beto O'Rourke was here this
Klobuchar
weekend.
Klobuchar calls herself a neighbor.
Yeah.
And you were at we were with Beto O'Rourke at the Old Fashioned last weekend.
Yeah, on Sunday we
were
got together.
Impressed? Before.
Yeah. In fact, he answered a question that I was very, very impressed about how he answered a question about really when you go into military affairs, kind of like War and Peace sort of question.
Yeah.
It was probably the most thoughtful question that I have heard someone reply to on that. Of any of the candidates. So, I think as this process happens, it'll winnow and winnow till we get down to probably three candidates. And at that point, maybe I'll get involved. But right now, I would love all of them to take on some progressive policy initiatives that I think are important that'll help them next November and I think are important for the country.
Okay, but you like them on domestic issues. And there's a wide array of candidates and wide array of domestic issues. Are you scared about foreign affairs? And there, many of them don't have experience in foreign affairs. Tough nations like Afghanistan and Syria, et cetera?
Yeah, considering Donald Trump's experience was trying to sell things to people in other countries, that was his experience in foreign affairs, I don't know if that's going to be a measuring stick. I mean, maybe people will decide he had no experience and that was a problem. They'll want someone with experience. We're going to figure that out through this process.
Okay. How do you react when Mr. Trump tweets, as he did last weekend, "I've got the police, the military, the bikers, and they're not yet playing tough"? This comes on the heels of Mr. Cohen telling Congress he's concerned about how President Trump would accept being defeated in 2020. Just your reaction to that tweet.
Yeah, unfortunately, it follows so many other tweets he's said of similar vein, right, that appeal to the worst in us, not the best in us, that are threats rather than, you know, something that's inspirational. And all too often, you know, his tweets are, I think, racist in nature. They divide us. They're never inclusionary about bringing the country together. And that's Donald Trump. And that's why I'm always amazed that this guy ever became president to begin with. But the fact that he made it through a process meant that there is something he's saying that's resonating. I'll give him credit on this. When he said drain the swamp, I think that was a brilliant branding of a real problem. I mean, Washington is overrun by special interests, and the average person does get pushed out all too often as we're doing public policy because of it. The problem is Donald Trump didn't tell him he's just going to drain the swamp deeper and build a high-rise luxury condo on it. You know, he brought his own swamp creatures in, and that's what's happened. But his message, I thought, was really valid. And that's one of the things that we ran on as Democrats last November. We took the majority, and that's how we passed H.R. 1, a comprehensive election, campaign finance, and ethics reform bill. People know that Washington isn't working for them, and I think it's smart for all of us to acknowledge that and admit that up front, and then offer how we're going to try to change it, because clearly this experiment hasn't worked with Donald Trump.
Well, what are the odds, though, that President Trump can hit the same nerves leading up and the same popularity and win re-election in November 2020?
I think far less, based on a lot of polling right now, based on the fact that he hasn't lived up to what he promised. I mean, I would argue one of the reasons he won Wisconsin. I mean, part of it was Democratic voter drop-off. Hillary Clinton never came. Part of it was a lot of the voter laws that Scott Walker put in place, that the University of Wisconsin said about 40,000 people were probably disenfranchised, and Trump won by 23,000. Mm-hmm. And part of it, I think, was the trade message. You know, I grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where 14,000 people out of 70,000 used to make cars. No one does today.
For AMC,
yep,
one does today.
American Motors, Chrysler later, but American Motors at its peak. Now you can work at the Amazon Distribution Center and make up to $12.75 an hour. Well, your parents did that three decades ago.
Yep.
That was an area where Hillary Clinton had a 7,000 vote drop-off. Only 1,000 more people voted for Trump.
7,000.
A lot of people stayed home. So I think that trade message now is blowing up in his face. Talk to any soybean farmer, dairy farmer, Harley employee. Go down the list of things because of his disjointed trade policies, because he clearly doesn't have a clear trade policy. A lot of industries are hurt in the state, and I think he's had the biggest drop-off in Wisconsin of any state he won. So I don't think he's going to do all that well as of right now. I don't think he can hit the same tones. I think he's always got his racist banter that's going to always get him 25-30%. But then the question is, where else does he go from there?
Okay, we're almost out of time. Two more questions. How did your party win the Democratic National Convention coming to Milwaukee next July 13th through 16th?
You know, I think a part of it was what I just said. Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania never should have gone to the Republicans, the industrial upper Midwest, and it's important to come back to show that you recognize that as a political party. I think part of it is, you know, Wisconsin is a state that we just elected all the Democrats' constitutional offices were Democrats, and that certainly sent a message that we're a state that is very purple, you know, and if we want to be more indigo blue, we're going to have to do more things like this. And I think, you know, the two places we were competing against were Houston and Miami and Milwaukee. And I don't know about you, but in the middle of summer, I would much rather go to Milwaukee than Houston or Miami.
I went to a national convention in Houston. I kind of understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think that hurt.
Okay, top goal this session, 2nd Congressional District for you. Just narrowly 2nd Congressional District.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think my top goal is my work on the appropriations process. I have enormous respect for Dave Obey. I think Dave Obey was one of the finest members of Congress the state's ever sent.
Chairman.
Chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And, you know, part of your job is, I think too many members of Congress don't consider their job their district. They think it's what they do in Washington. To me, my number one priority is the district. Number two is the Washington stuff. But if I can do things through the appropriations process that are good for Wisconsin, good for the University of Wisconsin, good for things that Governor Evers is trying to get done, I'm really happy to use my place on that committee and use that seat at the table to get something done. And I really want to get that done. So I think that's my top priority. We've got water quality issues in the district and the state.
Yes.
We need to help on transportation because Scott Walker for too long didn't invest. So I've got to be a part of that. our university system, again, I think Scott Walker left not in as good of a position as it could have been. We need to figure out how to do some things there, especially with the federal monies that come to the system. So there's a lot of work that I can do, and that's a priority.
Well, you mentioned Governor Evers, and that's prompting what will be my last question. You're missed by Democrats in our capital. Here's my scenario. If the Republicans throw away Governor Evers' proposed budget and enact their own budget, what should Governor Evers do? I hope he watches the show and takes your advice.
Yeah, he can veto it. I mean, he's got the power of the veto. They have to understand that, right? And that means they should be negotiating with him. And I think they've come out so far this session weaker because they've come out with fists flying. And, you know, Tony Evers is quintessential Wisconsin, right? I mean, he played euchre on election night while he's waiting for election returns. He had a polka band because he likes it at his election party.
Budget message, folks, three times.
Folks, and when he says golly gosh, he actually means golly gosh. And you can't come at someone with fist flaring when someone is one of the most approachable, nice person. I mean, you can negotiate with someone like that, and they're not willing to. I don't think they're in a good position right now. So I think if they push too hard, hopefully the governor will do what he should and veto that and find a way to get a path forward. But so far, I haven't seen him do a bunch of things that are outside the mainstream of what needed to get done in the state, and I hope that they allow him to be the governor like they should.
Second District Congressman Mark Pocan.
Yep.
Thanks for stopping.
Thank you,
Steve. Thanks for the update on
Washington. Of course.
Stop in anytime.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.